are actually put into a contracted police duty revolving fund. The director of public safety within the public safety department actually has the authority to enter into contract with individuals and companies and various functions. There's a set rate for our officers to provide coverage for those events per hour, and the money comes out of the contracted fund, and the person actually utilizes the service pays the county the going rate and everything. So it's a very well thought out and planned system. From my understanding, it's worked very well with the department managing it, assigning. And the other important factor is that, and the director and colonel is here, if I say anything out of line with this thing, but they take a look at the overall operational requirements, and they do not allow the contracted type services to interfere with the operational requirements on the street. So.
Any questions or comments from council? I'd like to recognize the president, Council President Kovac. Any questions, comments from the public? Moving on. We're scheduled here for an update on recent paramedic graduation, staffing, and operations. Chief Tan?
Yes, sir. Larry Tan from Chief of Emergency Medical Services. I have a copy of the presentation, so nobody has to take notes. Was asked to do a briefing on the current status of the Emergency Medical Services Division. I don't think it comes as any surprise that the paramedic service, as you've recognized, is doing better than a lot of areas within the national community. Just if you take a look at the number of accredited agencies, less than 1% of the over 19,000 EMS agencies in the United States are actually nationally accredited. So we're a part of a very small subset. In looking at the agenda, what we will cover today is EMS division staffing, recruitment, and our commitment for diversity, as well as EMS operations. In looking at the current EMS division staffing, we have 95 authorized paramedic positions, 91 of which are filled. So we have 4 vacant positions within the EMS division. One of the other things you have to consider is 5 of the filled positions are filled by paramedics that are out in the field certification process. So they're currently in a training mode and are not yet released for full duties. And 3 of those 91 filled positions are personnel that are finishing up their attendance at Deltec Community College in the paramedic program. They're slated to graduate in September or October of this year. The other thing that that we've talked about in the past have been what we call soft vacancies. And by soft vacancies, we refer to people that are currently in the position, are paramedics within the EMS division, but are in a status where we cannot use them for staffing. And in the first 6 months of 2012, the number of soft vacancies within the EMS division has ranged from 3 to 6 personnel. So that would be 3 to 6 personnel that we're currently not able to use. We had 3 paramedics currently on an FMLA status. We have 1 paramedic that's on a modified duty status, and that's ranged, again, in the first 6 months, anywhere from 1 to 3. And we have 1 paramedic who's on an extended military leave status, and we've had 1 and up to 2 people that have been on military leave. If you do a comparison of the EMS division staffing, when I reported to you in April of 2010, we had several vacancies within the EMS division. We had an EMS assistant chief vacancy. We had an EMS captain vacancy. We had 2 lieutenant positions, one of which was unfunded. We had 2 paramedic sergeants, both of which were unfunded. And we had 14 paramedic positions that were vacant, in addition to 4 unfunded paramedic positions. So looking over to the right on the screen, as of July 2012, the current status, the assistant chief's position is filled. The EMS captain's position has been unfunded for this fiscal year. We actually have 3 EMS lieutenant vacancies, 2 of which are funded to the paramedic level. And the goal there being that if we can fill the paramedic positions, when we make promotions, we don't have to create vacancies. We have 1 lieutenant position that remains unfunded. The 2 paramedic sergeant positions both remain unfunded this fiscal year. And the 4 paramedic positions that are vacant, all paramedic positions within the EMS division are funded. So the 4 that were previously unfunded have now been funded. Our goal for the current fiscal year is to achieve 100% staffing of all funded vacancies. We're making an absolute push to try and get all of our positions funded at this point. So what is the status with current funding, and how are we maintaining current operational staffing? Well, the reality is that we are still using overtime assignments to maintain current operating levels. In looking back at 3 months this current calendar year on day shifts, which is when we're looking at potentially putting up another power shift unit, in March of 2012, 90% of the day shifts required at least one overtime assignment to maintain current staffing. In April of 2012, dropped a little bit, only 87% of the shifts required at least one overtime position to maintain current staffing. In May, that's dropped a little bit more, 74% of the day shifts required. So the reality is if we want to add another power shift unit at this point, it would require overtime staffing and overtime funding. In looking at can we do it, we look at our EMS overtime budget. In fiscal year 2012, our projected overtime deficit for the entire fiscal year is going to be over $588,000. In looking at the reality that if we want to stand up a 7 day a week power shift unit, what would that cost us for 12 hours a day, 7 days a week? In looking at the overtime salaries and benefits, we're looking at an additional $626,000 to fund that on an overtime basis. So how does attrition offset some of the progress that we've made? Well, if you look at 2011, it was a zero-sum game. We had four paramedics and one paramedic candidate that ended up leaving us in calendar year 2011. We brought in a paramedic candidate that we recruited from Deltec. We also brought in four selective certification paramedics that were already trained, as we call ready medics. In 2012, in the first 6 months, we've had three paramedics that have left, but we've also brought six selective certification paramedics on board. So we're at this point ahead, but you can see how very similar to the police department, when they graduate an academy, they're short-staffed again, because during the life of an academy, you have people that retire and resign. We have a similar circumstance on a smaller scale, but it still impacts our gains within the agency. So I have to talk about the EMS graduation ceremony and the 2012 EMS graduation and appointment ceremony. One of the things to keep in mind is that these events, which are held during National EMS Week, are recognition of people who have achieved full certification during a calendar year. Of the eight people that we recognized this year in May, two were actually Deltec graduates. One was enrolled by Newcastle County as a student, so it was a county employee attending school. The second was actually hired after she completed the program, so it was somebody that we had recruited who was a free agent at the time, and that was not a county employee when she went through the program. Of the six selective certification personnel that we recognized in May, two were actually hired in late calendar year 2010 and actually were field certified during calendar year 2011. Three were actually hired and certified during calendar year 2011, and one was actually hired in January of 2012, and she did very well and graduated or successfully completed the field certification program and was eligible for recognition at our graduation appointment ceremony. So, you know, one of the questions has been, well, you've got eight people, are they new people? Well, the reality is that they've gotten phased in over a period of time. The graduation and appointment ceremony is recognition that they've achieved all the requirements for state certification, have been released to full duties, and are serving now. The other question becomes diversity. I mean, the good news is we've made some progress, particularly with women. The not so good news is that we aren't making progress with minorities to the extent that everybody would like. But in looking at what we've done, here are some of the initiatives that we've taken and some examples of some new programs that we've started as well. We continue to recruit through national advertisements. We continue to recruit through the county's website as well as the EMS division website. We continue to do EMS and public safety job postings regarding our recruitment activities. We are recruiting from Deltec paramedic classes for people that are not affiliated with any other agency. And we're also recruiting from out-of-state paramedic training programs. We have received referrals. Councilman Powers provided some contact information regarding one of his constituents who apparently had expressed an interest in becoming a paramedic. Both the EMS division as well as the chief human resources officer reached out to the individual, He's not yet made a decision on where he wants to go, but he's been encouraged to reach out and contact us again if he decides he wants to pursue a career as a paramedic. We continue to do on-site recruitment at a national EMS conference where we are offering people an opportunity to work with our agency. And actually, in March of 2012, our presentation at that conference got us a couple of applicants. So we're seeing some progress. We recognize that in developing paramedic students, we need to reach down into high school students and make sure that they're aware that there are opportunities to become paramedics. And when we have opportunities to reach out to some of the technical high schools that have EMS programs or public safety programs, we're going in doing a presentation regarding paramedics and EMS as a career. We're making sure that those students are aware that if they're graduating from a Delaware high school with a C or above, they're eligible for the SEED program and can actually attend Del Tech and have the SEED scholarship pay for their tuition. So we're making sure that people understand that EMS is a potential career. We've been participating in the congressional job fairs that our federal delegation has been hosting in all three counties. We have paired up with the Office of Human Resources to present career opportunities with EMS at these job fairs as well. One of the new initiatives was the hosting of a student intern. It's not something that we typically have done in the past, but we had a student from the Sarah Pyle Academy who had expressed during one of our presentations a really strong desire to get to know EMS and to understand what it takes to potentially become a paramedic. She developed a very strong relationship with Lieutenant Alston, actually came in, was hosted. She assisted us with some presentations to include some of our recruitment activities. She came and helped us staff our booth during the University of Delaware job fair. She actually brought her family to the EMS graduation and appointment ceremony the year she graduated from school, just to get to know the staff and to meet the people that she'd been hanging around with. So something new. We'd not hosted a student who had expressed that strong of a desire to explore EMS. Another new event that we hadn't previously been invited to participate in was Operation Success, the YMCA Black Achievers event, which was held on March 31st. And this is an opportunity for us to focus on African-American recruits. And we actually had two paramedics, Yvonne Russell on the left, who was actually a new graduate, was recognized at the graduation appointment ceremony this year, and Autumn Tuxford, who is a paramedic first class who's been with us for several years, actually do a presentation to the group regarding EMS and paramedic careers, and actually was doing their presentation alongside someone from the Wilmington Fire Department. So we're taking advantage of opportunities to reach out. We've certainly participated in some of the high school career fairs as well. For the past 2 years, we've participated in both the Middletown High School Career Fair as well as the Appaquinimet High School Career Fair, and also the Thomas Edison Charter School Career Day. So we're trying to make sure that high school students understand that there are viable careers within EMS and there's options and pathways to get the education beyond just finding a job to go to school. In looking at EMS operations, in the first 6 months of the current calendar year, we've responded to almost 15,000 ALS incidents throughout Newcastle County. In looking at the call volume in the MOT area, about 1,000 events. North of the C&D Canal, 13,700 some odd events. We've actually handled 13 or responded out of county for 13 incidents to provide assistance to border counties.
Question.
Yes, sir.
So ALS means advanced life support?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
These are our advanced life support incidents, only those incidents involving our agency. And as you're aware, we are what we call an ALS intercept agency, so there's probably another 15,000 plus incidents that don't even get a paramedic response because it doesn't reach that level of response.
Councilman Bell.
Mr. Chairman, Chief, when you look at like percentages, do you take into consideration land mass, travel time, time of day, weekends, Because, you know, it's one thing to look at 1,034 ALS incidents in southern Newcastle County as only being 3.75%. But what about the other factors of distance? I mean, you're looking at a pretty large landmass. I know there's time constraints that have been set up as far as reaching patient for patient care and everything. I don't see any of that there because, you know, quite frankly, I mean, you've got Route 1, Route 896, you got major highways. What's the consideration for those factors to be play into the percentages?
Well, the percentages that are shown here are strictly where the activity is. You're absolutely correct. The area below Newcastle County as a landmass area is large. Now, there are portions of that landmass that are uninhabited. Certainly there's marshland and others that doesn't factor in, but you're right. Time and distance is a factor. Activity is also a factor. And actually, later on here, I've got some of the response time information that's been requested as well. Our current operations, we have 8 paramedic units that are staffed on a 24-hour day, seven-day-a-week basis. We have a 1 power shift unit that's up on a 12-hour day, seven-day-a-week basis. And we have 1 day shift paramedic unit that we are staffing during holidays, as well as NASCAR weekends when Dover is expecting crowds. When you've seen this graph during our annual budget presentation, it shows in 2011 the call volume by time of day, and when you look at the power shift and when we're staffing Medic 10, you can see that we're looking at the higher call volume period. So it just kind of gives you a picture of why we do that power shift configuration. We're trying to apply the resources during the high call volume time periods. In January through June of 2012, Medic 10 has been placed in service in the southern MOT area during holiday weekends, NASCAR events at Dover Downs. We have put it up for weather contingencies. One of the things, as Councilman Bell said, time and distance. When we know that when we end up with inclement weather such as snow, we're not going to be able to get from point A to point B anywhere as quickly as we would normally do it. So we will typically try to increase the number of units, also as a contingency if somebody gets stuck when you're trying to go to a run. We've also had some road access contingencies. DelDOT has periodically shut down the Summit Bridge for repairs and maintenance, which means we have limited access to get down to the MOT area. And we've added a medic unit in the MOT area to accommodate the fact that we're going to have less access to that MOT area. As of January through June of 2012, there have been 14 responses, emergency responses, handled by Medic 10. It's been in service for 9 days. Most of the holidays actually occur later in the year, so that's one of the reasons why. For comparison, in calendar year 2011, Medic 10 made 70 responses and was in service for 45 days during the year. One of the questions that we've been asked to look at is response time. And this graph is a comparison of Kent County, Newcastle County, and Sussex County for the higher priority types of responses that may have some time-sensitive circumstances. We actually perform, and if you look at the bottom with the actual response data that is tracked by the Office of EMS, we're clearly doing probably twice the activity that Sussex County does and probably 3 times the activity what Kent County does, and we've reported that previously. And our response time performance is actually comparable, if not better, than the other 2 counties at this point. So we're in the range with the rest of the state at this point. In looking at our response time data for January through July 4th, what we call echo level response, these are the highest ALS priority, they're time sensitive circumstances, these are people not breathing, potential cardiac arrest. 72% of the time we had a paramedic unit there on scene within 8 minutes and 59 seconds or less. For the next lowest priority or second priority, what would you call a delta level response, we had a paramedic unit on scene 63% of the time within 8 minutes or less. For a Charlie level response, which is the lowest level that would warrant a paramedic level response, these are people that are conscious and breathing or not as time sensitive, about 62% of the time we had somebody there within 859. If you combine everything, you look at all of our paramedic incidents, regardless of priority, and put them all in a box, our overall would be about 63.5% within 8 minutes or less. One of the other things that we've talked about when you look at an ALS intercept agency is we're not the only responder. We're not the only ones going to these scenes. If it's a paramedic level response, we're going with the volunteer fire service or another ambulance. If it's an echo level response, typically that's going to involve a police response as well. Cardiac arrest situation, we call it like a Marine Corps response because police are being notified. They may have an AED, but they can certainly do CPR. Fire departments are notified, and they have officers that may have first response or AED capability and other pieces of apparatus, and the paramedics are going as well. If you look at all of the ALS cases and look at all of the responders, there will be an EMS responder, be it fire department, be it a fire company ambulance, be it a paramedic unit, that will be on that scene in 87, almost 88% of the time within 8 minutes or less. That's countywide. So what are we looking at? I mean, hopefully everyone agrees that the paramedics continue to provide very high quality of patient care. We're making progress with staffing. Certainly the fact that the 3 months we're seeing a reduction in the need to rely on overtime assignments to maintain our current operating levels is progress. An additional paramedic unit, we will staff it up as soon as new paramedics are available from certification and released to full duties. We will do that on a daily basis. If there are people available, we find a period of time when nobody wants vacation and we haven't had anybody mark off sick and we have the people, we will put the unit up. We will even put an additional responder in the MOT area if we have one paramedic. We will put a responder below the canal as an ALS responder. Attrition and soft vacancies are going to continue to be a factor. They fluctuate, as you saw earlier. They continue to create fluctuations in what available staff we have to put up paramedic units. And overtime staffing is a short-term answer rather than a long-term solution. Aside from the cost, there's also wear and tear on the workforce, and we're concerned about that. We certainly don't want to create hardships on people's personal lives or physical hardships on them as well. And we maintain our strong commitment to diversity. We're looking for other ways that we can bring in a more diverse workforce. In closing, just as a public safety message, the Office of Highway Safety is actually doing a click it or ticket campaign where they're highlighting the need to use seat belts for prevention of injuries, and our personnel have actually participated in that campaign. We certainly don't need the business, and we would urge you to wear your seat belts at all times. We'd be happy to answer any questions.
Before I have a question, I want to recognize the President, Councilman Shelton, and I just want to say to you, I've perused this before you made your presentation, and got to the section on diversity. And you know, I'm the first one to raise hand and say a whole lot of negative things when I see something wrong. But given what you've done at the local level, you know, I'm convinced that you're acting in good faith, and I commend you for the efforts there. If you know the kind of kids that are placed in Sarah Webb Powell Academy. You know, these are kids who numerically, statistically, not supposed to graduate. And you got a kid excited about something to the point where the kid and the family's coming out. So, you know, it's a good faith for everyone. I want to commend you on that.
Thank you, sir.
Councilman Smiley.
I just think everyone should be aware of all the obstacles. You know, you mentioned Councilman Powers first. Well, let's be fair. I was at Lone Pine with my grandson. Young man came up to me, saw my name on the van. I took the time, we had a very nice conversation, very personable with young man, very impressive. I talked to him, I got his information, I had him forward the information to me. I'm feeling good. Pass it along. Lo and behold, there's a pass there. There's legal issues, there's this, that, you know, maybe he'll find a place with a volunteer fire department because he was an interest there. But he was a prime example of here's someone who shows the interest, seems like a real nice guy. But he's got a criminal history there that isn't someone that's going to be representing county out on the street with the people. And I know this is something that you go through the application process and everything else. And don't get me wrong, it hasn't soured me on anyone that's interested. I'm going to move them forward. But I just want to say, you acted very quickly, very swiftly in reaching out to this gentleman, reaching out to his parents, making the contacts, doing the research. At the end of the day, he realized he had some issues. But I appreciate that. But that's something that we don't see that you go through, I know, with every application process, as all the public safety divisions do. I mean, I for the life of me, I can't figure out why someone with a felony record would ever apply to be a police officer. But I know they do. I know they do. I guess it's like the old thing, the best way to stop, you know, bank robberies is to hire a bank robber to do your security. I don't know, but it just still amazes me, and that showed in some of the numbers that I asked for. So I think you're definitely on the right track, and we're all here to try to help them bring people forward and pick the good ones.
Councilman Carney.
Yes, I think it's a really excellent briefing and overview, and I appreciate the level of detail that's here. And I'm just going to, you know, continue to advocate this line, especially when it comes to our public safety division, EMS, and police. You know, again, what kind of role do you see, if any, looking at our veteran community? We're going to be demobilizing, you know, tremendous amounts of folks here in the very near term. Lots of potential candidates with the battlefield medics, and I know we had this discussion. Maybe we just review that once again, see if there's any way that those folks can transition in with some kind of other certification. Is another area of folks to recruit for the EMS division.
I know that military transition is something that's being looked at on a national level as well. And as we've discussed in the past, transitioning from a battlefield medic into a civilian paramedic is—it's not an equivalent. There's a bridge, if you will, mm-hmm. a level of bridge training that needs to take place. There's very few military medics that have the full training that would be necessary to be a nationally board certified paramedic, and those are typically in special forces, which have a longevity. They're probably not coming out right away. But I know that. The EMS educators at a national level are looking at what does it take to transition somebody from a combat or battlefield medic into a civilian paramedic, and they're trying to expedite that. Certainly, when we have military personnel to reach out, we make sure they understand here's where the training is available locally. If you have access to the GI Bill or other types of tuition assistance, there may be ways to use that as well, and we try to help. But from a direct recruitment standpoint, and under the Board of Medical Licensure and Discipline for the state, in order for us to bring somebody in as a ready medic, they have to have certain academic and certification requirements. Typically, the military medics don't have all of those requirements that would be acceptable to the Board of Medical Licensure and Discipline. So it's a bridge process, if you will.
And that process, is that a short program, or does that take a year or two, or how does that...
I don't know. I'm not sure if the EMS educators have actually come up with an acceptable curriculum. I think it's state dependent at this point on what that bridge would be. But there has to be sufficient contact, and it would probably require clinical rotations as well as a field internship in order to be eligible to take the national boards. What that would take, I don't know.
Seeing you, Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The ready medics is the same thing as a selective certification paramedic.
Yes, sir.
And we have six of those to arrive. Where are they primarily coming from? Usually we see more people transitioning out of here, but to see people coming here.
We're actually getting them from neighboring jurisdictions, Maryland, Pennsylvania, New Jersey. And one person actually was relocating from Las Vegas. He was moving out here for family reasons and applied to us, so we ended up getting him from Las Vegas. We've had people from Arizona that have applied. It's varied. We've had people from New York. There's a training program up in the State University of New York, up in Stony Brook? Stony Brook, New York, that has a paramedic training program. It's actually, has a good reputation nationally, and their director will refer some of the more advanced students. He'll make a personal recommendation, and we've actually gotten two or three students from that program. So it depends.
I don't recall this happening before. Have we had this number of selected certification paramedics come on board here in recent years? We've had about the same amount?
We've actually ended up with more. The students that we have in the paramedic class of 2011-2012 are the last students that we have actually enrolled in a program. We did not enroll anybody in the Deltec program in March of this year. We've elected to try and fill with the selective certification paramedics and try to recruit eligible personnel from that are graduating out of Deltec. So we'll see how that works out. But we have. Over the years, we've had a number of selective certification candidates. I can't give you percentages right now of our total workforce, how many were selective cert versus how many are the people to be trained, but we've been seeing a growing number. And that's partially because we've been doing the national advertisements.
Good.
Councilman Redd.
Thank you. Chief, you said you had some fluctuation of personnel coming in and going out. What is the eligibility for retirement right now, and then how many can be replaced?
I think as it stands right now, we have 8 or 9 people that are immediately eligible to retire. So they could give their notice and they could retire, many of which are in supervisor or staff positions. Over the next 2 years, that will increase to somewhere around 14 people that are eligible to retire.
What's the prognosis of any of those retiring right now compared to what we're bringing recruits in or ready medics?
I guess it depends on their personal situation, whether there's a better offer that they want or whether they're in a financial situation where they
retire. You don't have any idea on that?
I don't know. I know how many people are eligible. It's one of the things that we track. How can we replace people? The executive's office has been staying on position with any vacancy that's funded filled. So
basically, it's a tough thing because whoever retires, you're going to replace them. And then you're still back where you were in the beginning.
Correct. Well, as you saw in 2011, we had 5 people that left, and we had 5 people we brought in, so it's a zero-sum game.
It's still negative.
But we're continuing to, one of the things that we've done with the Office of Human Resources is we actually have a very detailed tracking of how many applications are we getting in selective certification. The Office of Human Resources has been very good about fast-tracking those applicants and making sure that they process them quickly. And we, every week, we're looking at where's the list, where do they stand. Our recruitment staff is reaching out. We don't have this information. Are you still interested in the position and moving forward? So we're continuing to watch that. As people retire, we hopefully have a pool of applicants that we can use to fill the position. We're going to continue to advertise and promote the organization. And it's actually been pretty steady. We're seeing applications coming in on a fairly steady basis.
Thank you.
Co-Chairman Bell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chief, when you look at your vacancies and unfunded positions, I mean, we were all in agreement with the fact of funding from some of the different positions to go to the paramedic level to try to get operations boosted up, and it appears that you've done pretty well there. But when I look at a EMS captain and a EMS lieutenant not being funded, from a standpoint of maintaining the future, sustaining management levels in the future, from the standpoint of quality assurance, recruitment, retention, is there a void there by not having those positions filled?
I mean, there's certainly concern about continuity of operations and succession planning. You know, we're continuing to work with the executive's office to try and look at whether there are ways that we can fund those positions and move them forward. I mean, it makes it certainly difficult to manage the tasks that we are, but we continue to try and press forward.
Okay, good political answer. from the standpoint of quality assurance and quality improvement, is there someone doing that full-time right now?
No. We are asking the lieutenants to do quality improvement at the platoon level, and we work with the medical directors to try and maintain a level of quality insurance. When we do have someone that we can assign full time, it's probably the priority item that we will assign someone to. For an agency that's doing highly technical medical procedures, it's important to have a unified quality improvement program.
Well, that's my point. I think that, you know, since you've, you know, you're attaining getting positions filled and whatnot, I think we're probably getting at the level now where quality insurance, quality improvement is a full-time job. And with the number of responses that you have, the level of service that you're responsible to provide, the scrutiny that the paramedics come under from medical control, I don't see how the operational lieutenant can maintain that level of quality assurance and everything. So is that a lieutenant or a captain's position?
It's a lieutenant's position. Lieutenant. I mean, the plus that we have is that the staff, the supervisory staff that we have are assigned generic titles. We can assign them to whatever activity we want. But in the past, the quality improvement coordinator has been a lieutenant's position.
So there is a void right now, though. I mean, it's from the standpoint of, at some point, we've got to look at getting a couple of those staff positions filled.
It would be helpful.
Okay.
Any other questions, comments from council? Any questions, comments from the public? Chief, I'd like to thank you very much for the presentation. I'm sorry.
My name is Mike Scott. I'm an intern here. I was curious with the you're trying to figure out how to increase the diversion. I mean, thank you. Do you guys go name for specifically aimed high schools, or how do you guys aim for that? Or?
We'll go to, part of it is to go into a high school, you have to be invited. And we have relationships with some of the career staff and some of the educational staff within the different high schools. We will we'll do presentations where we're invited. Howard Career Center has a public safety track. So their public safety faculty try and expose the students to fire, officer emergency management, EMS, and police functions. St. George's Technical High School I guess that's classified as Middletown, actually has an EMS program as part of its program. There's a charter school, the Delaware Public Safety Charter School is focused on public safety. So we'll go and do presentations at any high school that invites us, and if you have an interest or a connection in yours, let us know. Be happy to try and come out and do a presentation.
I'm sorry, I missed you, sir. Do you have any suggestions for the chief as to where he might consider going?
No,
yes, sir.
And the finance office. Just to remind council again, we talked about reimbursement. We currently get 30% reimbursement from the state on the paramedic program as a whole. A few years ago, back up to 60%. That is $4 million annually that we've had to incur in cost. The tax increases that we did 3 or 4 years ago to pay for this additional cost. That's $4 million annually to our budget. In that effect.
Chairman Bell.
Just to build on that, and I know it's been a topic that has come up several times at the Delaware Association of Counties, and fact is it's a state, a lot of the requirements, prerequisites of the program are state mandated, medically mandated. The state wants to oversee it, but the state only wants to put up 30%. So it is a real big problem. The one final question I had, I guess, was we have a unique situation here in the county where we have a very active fire, rescue, and emergency medical service. And I look at what Bill Powers suggested as far as the young gentleman from Middletown Fire Company, who was their emergency medical technician of the year, to reach out to him and try to encourage. But I still go back, Timmy Sheldon will still go back, okay, to the fact of, is there room, is there an area where we can take a look to partner
with the medical community, with the volunteer emergency medical technicians who are nationally certified programs, to have an apprenticeship program, to look forward to trying to get folks coming out of high school, folks that are active from sometimes age 16 and 17 in their local communities, to try to have a piece of that become an apprenticeship program to go towards ultimately becoming a street certified paramedic. I don't know whether any more thought. We had a conversation here probably within the past month or so about other areas, other departments in the county that are incorporating apprenticeship programs into it. It seems to me with that core group of people that are out there that it might serve us well to try to have an active discussion as to, is there room for an apprenticeship program from emergency medical technician level working their way into a full-time paramedic position? And I didn't want to speak for Tim, but I can tell you that the two of us have talked about this and a lot. Joe, we've had conversations. You know, it just seems like it's a natural fit. Just, I don't know whether there's any more thought or interest that may be given from the HR standpoint and the public safety department to try to take a look at that.
Any other questions, comments on this subject matter? Okay, moving on. We're supposed to have a discussion.
Mr. Chairman, in all due respect, I mean, I guess I'd like to have an answer. Is there any interest? Is there any thought been put into it? I mean, we have, I think, a nationally certified, nationally recognized, we have an excellent paramedic program, but we have some excellent candidates out there in the volunteer fire service that could, given the opportunity, to maybe go through an apprenticeship program, and maybe some of the high school students that would want to get into an apprenticeship program and offer them some of the educational pieces. Is that something that is falling on deaf ears? Is it something that we can attain ever? Or is it something that we should just, you know, that we can do, something that we can look into?
Larry Tan, Chief of EMS. I would say that right now there's opportunities that we've hosted members of the local fire service and actually riding along with the paramedics. So there are some fire companies that are part of their clearance process to become a full EMT on their ambulance. They want their personnel to actually ride with the paramedics for a different perspective. So we host that. Would there be an interest in looking at it? I think we're always willing to explore, with the caveat that right now the staff that we currently have is probably maxed out maintaining the paramedic service, and to take on additional projects such as managing an apprenticeship program, we probably need to address some of this staff infrastructure to be able to properly accommodate that. But we're always willing to look at opportunities.
And I would agree, and once again, good political answer, okay, but I think from the standpoint of the medical community, we need to engage the medical community. We need to engage the state. We need to engage the volunteer fire service and the department to maybe sit down and come up with some ideas as to how such a program could be implemented with HR involved. And I apologize, that's an important component, but I understand. But at the same time, we won't get to point B if we don't start at point A. And it would seem to me that it's worth looking into. It's worth to have some active discussions. I mean, they work right now side by side. They work on units. They ride with the paramedics. You know, I think, you know, it's just another avenue maybe to attract and train folks. So,
Coach Chairman, are you suggesting or perhaps requesting that Chief and Administration look at this and come back to us with a determination at a later date?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think we've talked about it a number of times, not looking that this has to be brought to the front of the burner where it's got to be next month, but I think we have an opportunity between now and the next budget preparation. We've got an opportunity to take a look at Dell Tech and some of the folks that are going to school there on their own. I mean, there's a lot of things that could be done, and right now the volunteer service is paying, okay, in most cases paying either full-time or part-time EMTs to ride the basic life support units. So in essence, you get into that combination paid volunteer component. And I think that there's probably folks out there that would love to make the emergency medical profession a, you know, their career. So I think there's opportunity out there more than what we realize. So, but yes, Mr. Chairman, at some point, I think it would be good to explore that further.
Greg Wilson, Executive Office. It's certainly an interesting idea and worth looking at, but we have to keep in mind that riding with a paramedic doesn't make you a paramedic. It requires schooling, it requires extensive study, and it requires certification, as has been pointed out already, by people other than the county. The state medical director has to certify and be satisfied with the education program. So it's certainly more of a long-term project than a short-term project. And nothing HR can do or the executive office can turn an EMT into a paramedic. So with those caveats, we certainly need to look at it.
Nothing can turn a laborer into an electrician unless you give him an opportunity. And so, you know, I don't know. I guess I'm looking at it from the standpoint of, you know, meeting, you know, the different trades and things. They train people. All I'm entertaining is to have some discussion with medical control. You know, that the basic life support system is part of the delivery of emergency medical services county. And, you know, they're side by side. And maybe they can't get the full-blown approval to apply drugs until they're certified as a medic. But I think there's certain applications that they could certainly learn and everything. And I don't want to get into a big debate. I just don't think it's been explored outside of the department and this county as much as it could be. We like to think of ourselves in Newcastle County and Delaware as being a model state. I think to have a apprenticeship program for folks in the you know, in the emergency medical community that's out there now, offer them a you know, a career in a paramedic program would be outstanding.
Well, certainly everybody's heard you loud and clear, and I'll be interested in seeing what they're able to come back with at a later time. Councilman Bell.
Thank you. I have to agree with Councilman Bell. I mean, we discussed this before. Just him and I and Councilman Sheldon. And I agree with you somewhat, Greg, on what you said, but at the same time, Councilman Bell did really clarify it. If you don't have the exposure for these people in the volunteer firemen to get the exposure of a paramedic, they're never going to know if they can make it or not. So they have to have the exposure to ride along, find out if they qualify, and then if they qualify, they go through the program like everybody else. And that's almost like an apprenticeship program. And that's the only way it's going to work, exposure. I know different people that went from trade to trade. So there's nothing new about it. We're not reinventing the wheel here.
I would suggest that somebody who rode along, some people ride along, would come to the immediate conclusion that they didn't want to or couldn't do that.
Yeah, I just want to reiterate. I mean, look, I get this. We were both on channel 12, I get the DVD, you know, but I brought this up. I keep all that stuff. Councilman Bell's right. Look, I was a laborer. I didn't want to labor no more. I became an apprentice bricklayer, and that's, you know, I could watch and see the trade enough that I think that the people that are out there as first responders, though they can't do the medical, they're there first before our paramedics are in a lot of situations and accidents. And so they do have some exposure. I don't think I think Councilman Bell said it correctly when he said, you know, they don't have to be able to do this, you know, ride alone or any of that stuff. But we just know that these people, as Councilman Street just said, he's a no. And there's a lot of people that are no's. These people have been working in the fire companies for 10 years are above maybes, they're almost a yes, because they're doing it already. And that's the only reason why we ever brought this up, is because of the turnover situation at one time was 35%. I remember I played this thing about 6 months ago. It was fascinating. It was on WHYY in 2008. And reading it and seeing it, but the Economic Times, I think, is helping this situation a little bit for us. Because the nursing industry is down, believe it or not. They're not hiring as many. So we've got a good way of working this out right now. But I'm looking about 4 or 5 years down the road. I think whatever we set as a precedence now can help us down the road. And I'll never talk about this again.
Yeah,
okay. Just show it to the DVD.
No, just look at the address. I'll make copies for the DVD. The chief was on it. I was on it. So you can take it from there. We can play it on there.
Did you ride with K-9?
No story. Councilwoman.
Thank you. Coming out of a family that had a daughter that was an EMT, a son-in-law who's a paramedic, and my EMT found a real job, didn't like a real job, and is now in nursing school. So I think that you're correct in that if you can do the EMT job, and that's a really, it's a hard job if you've never done anything medical before. If you can't do EMT, you certainly aren't going to be able to do paramedic. I would think that certainly a good starting point would be to have information within the fire companies so that those kids coming in, I mean, my daughter went into this at 18 years old. You know, they did the classes. She did her state certification, national certification, everything that she needed to do, and rode for a couple of years. But she did it as a pastime because she was in college. I don't know that anybody ever said to her, you know, this is a track that you could follow and it could become your profession. So maybe to have something within the fire companies that shows them that, you know, you did the basic here, you just do a little more and you then have a professional track, maybe we would see some of these kids that completely drop out of it go in that direction.
Larry Tan, Chief of EMS. Well, there's two things to kind of keep in mind. One is that if someone's an active EMT, they're going on the same calls that we're going on. They're watching the paramedics work and working with the paramedics and assisting them, and they're riding in the ambulance in the back with the paramedics going to the hospital. So they get a chance to see. In many circumstances, people that are going through EMT school to get their training are being taught by off-duty paramedics that teach. Mm-hmm. So that is an option. And certainly individuals that have expressed an interest, I mean, we've had fire chiefs that have told us, because the paramedics are based out of our station, or because we interact with them so much, or because I've got a member who later on became a paramedic, we've got people that are going on to become EMTs. One of the things that is also available for EMTs is what we call advanced skills. There are actual state protocols that allow EMTs with specialized training to go above and beyond and do other procedures that previously have been reserved for paramedics. And there's different types of breathing treatments. There's things called assisted medications, where a patient who has medications that would benefit under certain circumstances, the EMT can help the patient self-administer their own medication. So there's actually some level beyond just an EMT that you can do as well. But I know that there are EMTs that have worked side by side with paramedics and have been encouraged to go to school. Consider becoming a paramedic and have that opportunity. And they do, on a daily basis, work side by side.
Anyone else? Okay. The next item on the agenda is a discussion in regard to the oversized motor vehicles, trails, and residential districts. And I don't know who had planned on or was supposed to initiate the discussion.
That's it.
What do you think? I got my whipping over.
Scott Fire, Public Safety, Police. I just feel any questions. We're currently working within the guidelines of the law. I have Lieutenant Wendy Hudson here, commander of the Community Service Unit. Her unit is tasked, when they're not wearing two hats, down on supplemental patrol, to go out and look at some of these issues and problems to either make the resident aware of a violation or to cite when we have to cite them. The new regulation touches on some new requirements as far as how wide and how long and how high and the weight which we go out, and all the police officers have been instructed of what the violations are. So I'll field any questions if you have any, unless the lieutenant can go over it real briefly. Yes, sir.
The only comment I want to make, and Senate Bill number 186 that was recently done was distributed, and that's one I addressed earlier. You know, and as far as this bill goes, it doesn't change any of the weights, dimensions, or any of the other parameters that we've had to work with since they initially went in. This just does the trailers being disconnected in the roadway. That's all this bill did. And I'm just going to say for the 7th District, what I do and what I've asked my constituents to do is when we have an oversized vehicle that has the business information on it, first we try to talk to the individual. Usually that doesn't work. Then we go to the business. If the contact with the business doesn't work, then we call into the police department. Because I know I actually sent a letter about 3 years ago to one of the big companies, and they were nice enough to put my letter in the paycheck of every employee in New Castle County that they had. So, but the ones I had a problem with went out of the neighborhood, so that's all that mattered. So I'm just saying that's what we do. But this legislation here, those weights and measurements were there. They're what we've been working with.
The bill actually changed. Senator Peterson was the author of the changes. We, as you know through your constituency, and I know through having community services unit and the traffic services unit, residential traffic and parking complaints are probably one of the most frequent calls you guys get, I'm sure, as do I. We were having some ongoing issues regarding that, dealing with the tractors, but the problem was how the law was worded. We didn't have any teeth to enforce that law because it was unattached from the vehicle, so it wasn't considered a motor vehicle. Therefore, we weren't allowed to cite. So that became a sticking point. Senator Peterson obviously went and amended it. So she changed it to make it unattached so that we can actually have some teeth to enforce that, whereas before the law did not provide us. That was like the loophole that nobody saw. And we'd go out there, but we couldn't do anything. And then the other part was the change to the bill was not the height or weights. Those are the same, as you said, but the parking within the confines or right in front of your residence.
Their own property.
Yes. I mean, as you know, my neighborhood, you know, the streets are, we're much more congested, the streets are smaller. Even a legal sized car is contendum, you know, calls an obstacle course on a residential street. So a couple trailers, that's why we start getting on the calls. But those are the two changes primarily, and that was why.
But unfortunately, some of those oversized, or some of the larger vehicles will have to stay on the street because they'll be illegal to go in the driveway or on private property. Because as we all know, county code has lower weights and lower limits. So we'll have to continue battling that safety concern.
We have been out to a lot of the ones since the new bill has been issue citations from some of our, for lack of better words, frequent flyers, frequent offenders, some of which are legitimate business people and some of which they just don't care. And I think they make it a personal point to see if they can get in a loophole. But we've gone out there, and what I've tried to explain to the senator even is that just because the bill allows me to now cite this person doesn't mean that me giving them a ticket is going to change their behavior. If they have enough of an attitude about this particular issue, it may take 10 tickets before they're going to decide to do anything.
Same
they
as
don't
code,
care.
Same
so,
as code enforcement. Yep.
I mean, while we are doing it, you also have to understand the attitude of some of our citizenry out there. So.
I got a question.
And if anybody has any questions about that or...
Turn.
I know that I field a lot of the calls from your offices or your aides about things, but keep sending them through, and if you need copies of anything, I can certainly get them to you so you can give them to your residents.
Councilman Sheldon has a question.
Yes, while you're up. Okay. We're starting to get inundated with these calls. Senator Peterson is my senator and so forth, and of course when we go to the civic meetings, she announces this, and it's fine. The problem is now they're calling us. They're not calling them. They're calling us. How many tickets does it? Because this is the part of being a council person. They just look at you and say, "How come your police aren't?" And they're actually, it's a reverse effect, kinda, because now they're looking at us. Well, you're not doing what the bill says.
get the same look.
And when, I guess what the, I guess that's not a good answer. I guess I'm not going to be able to answer this.
The answer to that,
how many is tickets does it take to get that?
That's not built into the law. You know, there is no subsection that says after 10, yeah, after 10 successful prosecutions, because you couldn't just be charged, you have to be found guilty, you know. So after 10, you know, guilty verdicts of this, then you can take it to the next level, and the next level is. Right now, that's not in there.
So
depending on if you come to my house,
I want
to
write that
or some citizen out there that are have businesses, they're like, tell me right away if this isn't legal. I'll go trade this in and get a different truck because I operate a legal business. Versus you have other citizens out there that, as I said, have a different mindset regarding the bill, and they do not care at this point. They are so fed up with whatever their issue is that they're willing to take 10 tickets on the chin before they're even going to blink an eye.
So you're saying the bill doesn't allow the ticketing.
It allows us to cite for just what it says, you know. If you're 6'2" and you're not allowed to be 6'2", then I can give you a ticket. I can give you 10 tickets, but, you know, what are you going
to,
you know.
There's no habitual offender status attached to it. There is no other offense as far as suspending your license.
Second or third offense.
Towing or impounding or anything else like that.
So they left the penalty phase off.
Like Lieutenant said, we had
some. That's what you're saying.
Today, he just wants to know what he has to do to be legal. And he's willing to go in and buy a new trailer because it's his trailer is about a foot too long or something like that.
1 foot.
So.
So he received tickets for the actual vehicle height, which we measured today in the lot and was under. So that's obviously a ticket he could fight and get out of. But the other was he was actually a foot over. And he's the one who said, I'll be willing to trade this thing in today. Then we have other citizenry without going into places, but they are so fed up with the county, period, whether it's the police or whether it's code or whether it's, you know, buildings or the law office, that, and they got it issued through the state. Their tags, they have vanity tags that actually have numbers, but when you run the number, it comes back, F-U-N-C-C. That's one. And then the other one says, kiss my, we give tickets to that guy regularly. He's not going to change his behavior because there's nothing to say in that law. After the fifth ticket, you can do X. Or he doesn't. He's one in particular that law, while it gives us the teeth to go out and cite him, he doesn't care how many tickets he gets. He's just going to keep taking them and keep paying them.
Councilman Cardi, Councilman Smiley, Councilman Compassion.
So when it comes to the state statute on these kind of violations, we have to. There's no implied authority to us that if a repeat offender, we can tow away the vehicle and impound it. We have to have that specifically written into the law.
The laws tell us specifically what we can and cannot do. If it doesn't say that we, after X amount of offenses, convicted offenses, or after so many calls for service, like the nuisance abatement type things, for apartments, try to translate that to apartment situation, that we can go out and tow it.
Oh, right.
I mean, if I come and park my car in front of your driveway or in your driveway, then obviously, you know, you can do something about that. But outside of that, I mean,
the police could tow in that circumstance?
Mm-hmm.
If someone's blocking someone's
driveway. If I'm in your driveway and I come home and there's a car I don't know.
In the driveway. How about if you're on the street? Blocking.
If you're blocking it or in it, either one.
You could authorize a tow for that. The police could. Right.
If it's but as the law states right now, like I said, I could give you, there is no standard.
Right.
It says three tickets, five tickets. So
she's
got to
tighten it up.
Like the false alarms.
That is prolific, Harmony.
You can go with you. Get that.
You can go confer with her.
So we have some teeth, and now we're finding holes in that. So it's just like any other law.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Prior to the trailer one, I mean, the existing law that was there, we had the same issue with that. It was oversized.
I dread that.
We can just keep selling. My question is, and
it's already,
we'll go beyond the unattached trailer because I'm not sure that's been enforced long enough for a valid evaluation to be made.
Yeah, right. I'm sure.
Are the magistrates going on the low end of the fine or the high end? Or do you have any inkling on that?
Okay. I don't know. As with other charges, there is a, you know, the low end and a high end as far as, and number of offenses, you climb the ladder, so to speak, towards the high end. I do not know.
Do our tickets have the if you send it in, you pay this flat amount. And so, I guess, where is it in there?
We'd have to
just
check.
Curious.
Yeah, but I don't know if the magistrates are. Okay, Wendy Hudson, I see on her record, this is her fifth ticket, so I'm definitely going to give her.
And I think it's a little early for that, but I think it's a little, because that was one of the concerns. That was a reason for a couple of the no votes in the Senate. They weren't happy that the maximum fine, because she used the other, was rather significant. I don't remember the dollar value, but it was rather significant. But I know with code enforcement, I hate to keep relating to that, but that was the issue we had when we all came into office, was that the magistrates weren't dropping the hammer heavy enough. And so it was more beneficial for the people to play the game with us for a year or so, then fix it up the day before they went to court, take pictures, and get everything dismissed.
Councilwoman Kopecky.
So we don't have the ability to add that onto county law. It has to go through state law to be enhanced.
I believe that would be the proper venue, since it's a state law, to have something.
We're second, third offense, or suspend their license, that type of thing.
Send it back to the state.
Towing, seizing.
And I don't believe the senator would have a problem with that.
We can address that with the senator.
Yeah.
The executive's office and make contact. Say she'd be receptive to that. I'm sure she would.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if we explain some of our unique situations. Whether most people get a ticket, they try to address their behavior. Other people.
I think she would be receptive.
And she realizes issues. I was with her today, and they're still having issues with the individual that actually created the need for this legislation.
I've had discussions with her about that situation, that particular case, and that's where we said, she was like, you guys aren't doing anything. Yes, we
exactly.
are. However, I can't make my ticket change his behavior. So she's aware of that. We've had those discussions, and I think that now that she went through all this trouble to get it changed, it's frustrating her that now, again, there's this other little loophole, if you will, that this guy is still...
Yeah, and
so I think she would be more than receptive to that.
By the time the legislature goes back in, there'll be enough stress there to, I think, move quickly on it.
And we'll document those cases.
Okay. Any other questions, comments from council? Any other questions, comments from the public? Moving on. My favorite subject. Discussion of police K-9.
Greg Wilson, county attorney. It was my understanding that council was going to defer that. Since scheduling this, we've also received a letter from an attorney representing the individual who was most recently bitten. So. We may, if you want to ask questions about that particular case, maybe more appropriate to schedule an executive session to address that. If you just want to talk about canines in general, that's different.
Okay, but
my understanding was that council had decided to defer this, so I don't think we've actually prepared a presentation on this.
Mr. Chairman, I'd make a motion if we defer this particular topic to a future Public Safety Committee meeting.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
We'll defer it then. Anybody have any questions, comments, anything under other?
No, we had to leave, so no.
Any public comment, any questions, concerns from the public?
I have a motion to adjourn.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Good job. We're adamant about
it.
Now we need to start.